Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Mourner. This is episode 47. I'm the co-host Mark Ames. I'm coming to you from Queens, New York, and I'm on the line with the Warnerd himself, John Dolan, Gary Brecher, and we have a special guest today from North Carolina. His name is David Forbes. We work together at the NSFW Corp. He is a journalist and writer, and he has a local, I don't know, online newspaper, I guess you call it, which I've been a subscriber to from the beginning, and it's very good. It's called the Asheville Blade. And David Forbes is an excellent journalist. He's also the author of The Old Iron Dream, and I'm going to say which is described as a no-bullshit critical look at the history of science fiction's far right and its long-lasting influence. It's really interesting and becomes increasingly relevant, especially as the techno world culture kind of overtakes politics. So David can hear me and John can hear me.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Thanks for coming on the show, David.
Yeah, thanks Always very much.
And so, David, we're going to talk about the Civil War and a side of the Civil War in the South that is rarely, if ever, talked about. John, why don't you introduce the story and go from there?
Okay. Well, David is something of an expert in the part of the war that people don't like to talk about, the part that wasn't all clean and conventional and chivalrous. I mean, this is something that, as an American boy, at least, you, in my generation, you grew up with, the idea that the Civil War was a gigantic struggle and a very bloody one. I mean, a horrendous number of casualties, but it was also unlike many wars fought by other nastier peoples than our own. It was a clean war in some way, where the soldiers were fierce toward each other but spared civilians. And you know, the classic anecdote about that is in the Battle of Gettysburg, there was one civilian death, and that was a stray bullet that hit a woman as she was doing the dishes. There were 50,000 plus casualties, but other than that, they were supposedly all combatants. And the thing about that is, it's true for some places and some points in the war. David, you and I will talk about this at length, but maybe we could say the further east you go, and the further and the earlier in the war you go, the more true that might be. But there's a lot of the war where that's not true at all, and where the American Civil War, if you really understand what was going on, looks a lot more like, say, the war in Syria than anybody wants to say.
I think that's very true. As a matter of fact, it started well before the war, and even at the literal start of the war during the secession conventions. There's a town right north of where I am in Asheville right now, called Madison, and or Marshall, pardon me. And it's in Madison County, which was this hotbed of, you know, absolutely bloody conflict between Unionists and Confederates. And during the elections for the secession convention, which they already voted against overwhelmingly, the sheriff, who was, you know, pro-Confederate, got incredibly drunk and, you know, started threatening people with revolvers. And by the end of it resulted in this, you know, massive brawl / shootout. And by the end of it, the sheriff and the son of one of the local Unionists were both dead, and a number of other people were injured or killed. And that's kind of how things started, never really let up, depending on the area. It did worsen over the course of the war. But this was going on well before the war in some areas like Kansas, and worsened in many of the kind of pockets of the, you know, future Confederacy, where people didn't really feel that Confederate at all.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you've lived in some of the areas where the very nasty guerrilla war between pro-Union Southerners and pro-Confederate Southerners were what was at its worst. Can you tell us about where you've lived and what those regions remember about this?
Certainly. It's an interesting example of, you know, local memory has a very strong hold. People pass down stories or stories get circulated around, especially both these areas have a lot of kind of tight-knit history. But also you've had this massive myth of the lost cause in the South, especially placed on top and often for, you know, many, many decades violently enforced as well. I grew up and was born and grew up in Northeast North Carolina, Elizabeth City, Camden County, the Great Dismal Swamp in that area, which was an absolute hotbed of fighting going on and, you know, death squad tactics, you know, bushwhacking, you name it. The Confederacy was really brutal in that area. And there was also a long, long history of rebellion, especially going back in the 1700s from ex-indentured servants and remaining indigenous populations and escaped slaves and African Americans, et cetera.
Is that where the regulators were from? The sort of like populist radicals from the 1760s and 70s?
Yes, I believe so. My focus is usually a little later, but it has a long, long history of populist kind of radicalism in there, and especially among the, you know, the Maroons or the Rogues, which was our terms that were basically used for in the really brutal kind of class society that was the proto-Confederacy for people that were not part of the plantation system, and usually that overlapped with people that they implied were in mixed race communities and oftentimes were. But they were organized enough that by the, you know, 1863, 1864, you have bands of 500 people, you know, they called them banditti and things like that, and, you know, the Richmond newspapers, they were pulling off raids considerably far north and around that whole area. And you obviously had the sort of response the Confederacy usually did to that, which was incredibly brutal. And then I live now and have lived for over a decade in Asheville, which was in the middle of Western North Carolina. And also it was pretty much the other main hotbed where there were a lot of Unionist sympathizers. There's a pretty good argument in both regions Unionists had a solid majority. And okay. Certainly there was go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say to you, I think, For those people who know anything about this aspect of the war, and it doesn't get played up much, there's this idea that it was based in Appalachia, and so it's a surprise when you say you are talking about northeastern North Carolina, right? Because the mountains are often associated with small farmers who didn't want any part of the Confederacy, but the other landscape of resistance, if you want to call it that, in the pre-war South is often the swamp.
Yes. Which is for similar reasons of terrain. The swamp is isolated. If you know the areas, it's a considerable, to use a modern term, force multiplier if you're armed and other armed people are looking for you. It's got, you know, the points where it's just dry enough to farm on will easily support, you know, a community or a small family, but they're not really friendly to plantations. And so there's a huge divide on the coast, North Carolina, between the southern part of the coast, Wilmington, which is this, you know, one of the last places to fall in the war, this hotbed of, you know, fire breather, sympathy for the Confederacy, probably the most ardent Confederate support in the entire state, and the Northeast, which is, you know, ardently either wants to be left alone or is even violently against the Confederacy.
I remember Wilmington. Yeah. Someone came up with a great plan to run a ship into the harbor against the fort and blow it up to get rid of it. They were so tired of having to deal with it. Didn't work either. Like those
plans. No, no.
Don't. So the more southern coast of North Carolina is generally pro-Confederate. The Northeast coast along the Great Dismal Swamp is where you find this mixed race, ideologically mixed sort of anti-Confederate sympathy.
Very much so. The West is, I think, where kind of things get focused on. And it's understandable because as far as like centralized regions within within the South, the Appalachian Mountains were the hotbed of resistance. And it wasn't just this state. It was, of course, Eastern Tennessee. It was, you know, it was what became West Virginia. It was on into Kentucky. So it's understandable that because that was your focus during the war and after, and rightly, there was a lot of resistance there. They had an easier time, easy in relative terms, getting to Union lines early in the war to join up with Union regiments.
It's hard for conventional armies to deal with those swamps, as you said. That, I mean, one of the traditions that I, as a, you know, a very traditional patriotic American kid of a generation much earlier than either of you guys, remembers Francis Marion, the swamp fox, and yes, the idea of the American rebel who hides out in the swamps and takes advantage of the lumbering, conventionally hidebound redcoats. But that tradition operated in other ways that American history doesn't like to remember quite as much, like the Seminole Wars, where it took an awfully long time to take a mixed Native American, African American, white population and basically crush them.
Yes. So the swamps, the mountains, and there are other spots that you'll get into a little more of ideological resistance, not just terrain, you know, places where you have strong, you know, Mennonite or Quaker roots. And even with the swamps and the coast, you have something that kind of works. You have a thing that goes together throughout the war on either side, which is you have these weird alliances between, quote, irregular forces and more conventional forces. And particularly in the swamp area and the northeastern coast, the fact that the Union did an amazing job of the combined arms with the naval and land regiments, and you also had friendly territory there with kind of some pro-Union support, was one reason why they made inroads in those areas way, way, way before they ever made them in the southern part of the coast in North Carolina.
So they were actually good at liaising with irregular troops. That's surprising.
Sometimes.
You don't associate that with American Victorian armies.
Sometimes they were, and sometimes they weren't. It varied massively by commander. Occasionally you'd run into commanders. You'd run into this, you know, things like the rightly famed and should be featured far more often Combi raid that Harriet Tubman led and coordinated, where you had commanders, usually people with a history as insurgents themselves in Kansas or Missouri or areas like that, who saw the value in this and worked just fine. But then you had, you know, this large argument between Grant and Sherman for a good chunk of the war about whether to, you know, mobilize the Appalachian region and make a decisive strike through there, which Grant had some sympathy towards. And then Sherman, who had very much this, you know, disdain for the irregulars, with some a few exceptions here and there.
One of the nastiest parts of Sherman's memoirs is his complete dismissal of the Southern Union man, whom he basically calls a myth. It's really shocking. I mean, Sherman is a strange
and it's interesting the degree to which, you know, the Victorian officer class, and it was around that time, just didn't perceive, it gets to kind of the heart of this dual image of the war. Even at the time, perceived the war as, you know, brutal, but these lines and set piece engagements. Even people like Sherman, who kind of saw beyond that to a fairly large degree with how, you know, ended up waging the war. And on the other hand, anything, and inside that, there was the possibility of these rules with captives, with paroled prisoners. Outside of that, you were just a bandit, and the treatment by the, you know, Victorian armies, whether they were, you know, colonial British forces or forces of the Civil War, was incredibly brutal on that front because you were outside this kind of legal area in their mind. And in the case of the Confederacy, they were bluntly trying to keep a social system prompted by violence. You know, that's what the whole war was about for them.
I mean, a lot of what had been the pre-war officer class was from the Southern elite, and a lot of it sympathized more or less openly with it. I mean, there was that horrendous moment where Jeff C. Davis, not the Jefferson Davis, one of Sherman's commanders on the march, more or less decides to abandon a whole column of slaves who are fleeing with the Union troops to the mercies of their former masters. And when you read memoirs by even Union officers, there's, as you say, an incredible variation commander by commander. theater by theater and also year by year, because like most of these wars, it gets nastier as it goes. And early on, I remember Colonel John Beatty drawing a distinction between Turchin, a strange Russian-American commander who let his men burn houses, and Don Carlos Buell. And he said, Turchin's policy may be that of the devil, but Buell's is that of the amiable idiot who says, dear Mr. Traitor, please do not engage in war against us, but if you must, we would prefer that you not bushwhack our troops as they are riding the train.
Yeah, that's very much kind of the gap. And yeah, of course, it varies as the war goes on. And frankly, there is a sort of a weeding out that goes on and a practicality that kind of sets in. You know, especially when the Union gets a lot better at raiding and counter-raiding against the Confederacy, you do see a real value placed on, for example, the Mounted Infantry regiments from West North Carolina, which were staunchly, zealously Unionist. And they, you know, form a major role being used in a number of raids, especially from 63 on.
Right. So you grew up in two areas that were very important in this understudied area of the war. So my first question is based on something a professor of mine once said. He had obviously developed it as an aphorism, you know, and he said it with proper dramatic timing. You know, I've just come back from a year sabbatical in Poland, and you know, they say Americans have no sense of history, and then dramatic pause. Thank God. But I don't think that's true for all these regions, is it? They have a very strong sense of this history.
No, I mean, you have the counter thing, which is, you know, Faulkner's somewhat oversample quote, you know, the past ain't even past. And that's very, very true. I mean, it's especially true in areas that are more marginalized in one way or another, and it's true among populations that are marginalized in one way or another, but you can't forget this history. You know, it is still literally around you all the time. There was a little more going on, and there were a lot of attempts, especially in the late 1800s or 1900s, to make a good chunk of the South forget this, and some successes on that front. Especially from the lost cause types with the very close to absolute control they were able to exercise in the early 20th century. Another interview too, there's a professor here who kind of chronicles the history of African American population, which gets very much roped into all this as the war goes on, and participates in it too, for obvious reasons. But noting that the Civil War was one of the first times that America had to grapple with having a history, with, you know, these events piling up, these political controversies piling up over decades, to the point where you were going to have this incredibly bloody war. And that was really previously America could have been, oh, political controversy, we'll do some compromise, and people don't like it, can leave for one of the many new states that are forming. But after the Civil War, you know, the Civil War is the point where, no, this is a country that's going to have to reckon with its divisions in some of the worst possible ways. And,
right,
you know,
so how did this develop for you? I mean, your family.
Yeah.
I mean, is it a generational thing? I mean, for me, growing up in California, I just always thought of, well, you know, mainly you read about the Army of the Potomac and you assume that it's going to lose every time. For various reasons.
And Hell doesn't, yeah.
And you're on its side, but the Confederates seem pretty good at what they do. But I was reading at the time, I was reading Charles Portis novels, and I had no sense, because Portis writes the greatest dialogue I know. But he's also very much a neo-Confederate from southeast Arkansas, which was a real stronghold.
Yeah.
And it took me decades to realize for him and for his family, because he confesses to this in some memoirs, this stuff is alive right now. So was it anything like that for you as well?
It was kind of an interesting mixed case. My grandparents, I grew up with a more left-leaning family than a lot of people in the region I came from. Grandparents were ardent New Deal Democrats and against segregation when that was a somewhat rare stance. So I grew up with kind of that perspective. At the same time, history had gotten so muddied and distorted by the Lost Cause mess during some of the aftermath of the war that a fair amount of that stuck around in the regular, like, popular culture. One example that kind of sticks with me, though, and that I've mentioned to you all a few times before, is know, I would, there was this grave of this former Confederate private and what turned out to be one of these, you know, basically partisan infantry, quote, or turned out to be bushwhacking death squad type units. And it was above ground. And that's kind of weird in the area I come from, unless you're really rich and have like some weird mausoleum or something, which a few of the older families do. And I asked my grandfather about it, and he said, well, yeah, the, you know, he had, his unit went to this family that was, you know, that was pro-Union and killed them. And when they were done murdering them, they realized that, you know, there was this infant in the house they hadn't known about. And this soldier was the only one, because this is something even they were blanching at, was the only one who went back in, killed the infant. And because [S2] Wow. [S1] Of that, he was afraid to the end of his life that the devil would come get him if he was buried under the ground. That sort of paranoia you get when you're clearly an awful person. And even by the standards of the time, which are pretty miserable, that you are an awful person and that you have done nothing but pretty much evil in your life. And the things that no moral system would ever forgive. And
that's one of those moments. I mean, you get that in the I always get the name wrong. I think it's the El Mozote massacre too in El Salvador, where most of the soldiers say no, we're not going to kill the kids, there are a few, because these guys always get recruited for outfits like that, who say, oh yes, we are, those are the orders, and we're going to kill them all, and they did.
Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting note, because there are actually this you know, there was a unit raised from a lot of these unionist areas that were for the Confederacy, were some of the most brutal. They were the ones who, you know, who would use euphemism after the war, like, we had no choice but to resort to, quote, severe and caustic measures to deal with, quote, midnight marauders. You know, it's Victoria, or we had to do heavy scouting in the area. It's these Victorian euphemisms for what was basically straight up butchery. But my granddad said at the time, you know, no, the devil got him anyway. You know, he was damned. He was clearly damned.
That's the thing you want to knock on the above ground grave and ask this dead guy, like, sir, aren't you kind of underestimating the devil's abilities here?
Yeah, so seriously, it's that weird kind of superstitious paranoia. And it's interesting that, you know, in a horrible, horrible way, the degree to which you see that in some of these, like, after war narratives, it takes a different form with the aristocrats, and the commanders of these, you know, really nasty units were almost always either low level aristocrats or aristocratic wannabes, because that's how the Confederacy worked. And you see them with these, you know, the more upper class ones of these long, florid justifications for, you know, like I mentioned, you know, we had no choice but take severe and caustic measures. And notably, that was one of the units, which was one of the ones, West North Carolina, the 64th, which perpetrated the Shelton Laurel massacre, which is reasonably famous as far as these massacres go. And thus,
Can you tell? Can you tell us about that?
Certainly. Yeah. Sorry. So the Shelton Laurel massacre was in West North Carolina. There was a unit raised, the 64th. Was early on called Allen's Raiders, I believe. You know, it was in Madison County, the same place I mentioned where this drunken shootout happened, you know, right before the war started. Madison County was staunchly unionist outside of the, like, very major, the town, you know, small towns that were this, you know, linked to this larger economy and political power structure. At one point, the commander sends one of his lieutenant colonels with the 64th to go, you know, retaliate force against some unionists for stealing salt, which is a really common, quote, war crime back in these days, because salt was so important to food, you know, being preserved at all. So any army's mobility. It's not something that gets emphasized that much, but, you know, there's a huge emphasis behind the lines in the Civil War on the Confederacy side of keeping slave labor and salt mines working and keeping salt mines open, keeping unionists from raiding salt. So they go to Shelton Laurel, which is this area famous for, you know, being a unionist hotbed, and they just kill a bunch of people. And at this time, it's clear that the war's becoming less and less popular, especially as the really harsh Confederate conscription regime starts to go into effect. In an area that doesn't have that many people, and where the absence of one laborer can lead to starvation. they masterfully, and this is part where the, you know, the Confederate kind of larger power structure and the, you know, we have to win this war at all costs mentality, which they had much earlier than a lot of the Union did, which has always been kind of an interesting myth about the war, that this collides with like the local power structure trying not to get killed, yeah. Because you have a lot of the, you have a whole bunch of the like local Confederate leaders who later become some of the architects of Jim Crow, people like Zebulon Vance and Augustus Merriman, who are like, whoa, this is way too far. We can't do this. Like, you know, and they're not doing this because they're good people. They're both devoutly devoted to upholding the slave system. It made them very, very powerful, wealthy people. But they were like, if we do this, you know, our hides are on the line, whereas your units, you know, your unit might rotate out of here a little bit.
As often in guerrilla war, the thing is, I got kids, my kids will have kids, and in this kind of warfare, nobody ever forgets, right?
Yeah, like, yeah.
Maybe talking about one of my kids getting shot in the back by one of your grandkids, way, way down the line.
Exactly. And also, I think there was some, though ironically, this proved to be false and one of the worst mistakes in American history. There was this idea that if the Union won, that they might be held accountable for war crimes, that they might be made an example of, and sadly that didn't happen to anywhere near the degree it should have, but they didn't know that at the time. And more so that if the Union swept in, which, you know, Grant was considering as a serious plan sweeping through the Appalachian Mountains, Lincoln pushed, you know, to link up with the Eastern Tennessee, Western Carolina Unionists more than once, that if that happened, that the old grudges would have more bayonets behind them, basically, and they would be hunted down. And so, yeah, there was very much that kind of reaction. But yeah, there were 13 people executed, probably a good deal more starved because this massacre was carried out in winter.
That's a good way to massacre people in a cold climate. I mean, you massacre them at a time when food is scarcest. And, of course, salt is part of that because salt – without salt, you don't have meat, not for very long anyway. And so salt has its own strategy. But you said one thing that I think is really, really important here and that I think a lot of people don't know, that the North pursued, the Northern officer class specifically, pursued a strangely velvet glove attitude against in most areas, at least for the beginning of the war. And I'm going to read a passage from the memoirs of John Beatty, who was an Ohio officer, who says, and he's speaking in frustration around early 1862, and he's speaking about the North. He says, "The white rebel who has done his utmost to bring about the rebellion is lionized, called a plucky fellow, a great man. While the Negro who welcomes us, who is ready to peril his life to aid us, is kicked, cuffed, and driven back to his master, there to be scourged for his kindness to us. Billy, my servant, tells me that a colored man was whipped to death by a planter who lives here for giving information to our men. I do not doubt it. We worm out of these poor creatures a knowledge of the places where stores are secreted, or compel them to serve as guides, and then turn them out to be scourged or murderers. Or murdered. There must be a change in this regard before we shall be worthy of success." And that's, of course, that gets at something that we haven't fully mentioned yet, which is the like huge, humongous, overwhelming place that race plays in all of this.
Yes, I don't think that can be neglected, because it's interesting. This is a problem even when some recent discussions about unionism in North Carolina and many other southern states have come up, which is they tend to focus on the white guy. And this is, you know, part of that myth in that gets constructed about the unified North versus the unified South, which of course is a complete lie, is partly based on this idea that all the Southerners were united, you know, the few weirdos here and there against the North. And a lot of crimes are really the cover up in them. And for some reason, it's always interesting to me in that black units and black soldiers and black insurgents, which were very plentiful and fought with a heroism that it's impossible not to admire, and people damn well should. But those numbers usually aren't factored in. For example, when you know, with some numbers I've seen say that, you know, 25,000 North Carolinians fought on the Union side, they're only talking about white guys. And it's interesting because when you factor the African American regiments in, for example, the area I came from, the Northeast, you had two white regiments recruited, and you had three African American regiments recruited. And when you start to factor those numbers along with the, you know, 500 plus strong groups of insurgents I mentioned earlier, the Maroons, and kind of these mixed race communities that have been there for a while, the idea of, you know, of the Confederacy representing, quote, the South starts to get a lot shakier. Right. But because the racism was so pervasive, including among many Unionists, this is a pervasively racist time, even among the, you know, people who were relatively progressive, those units tend to get dismissed, despite the fact that there's a good argument that, that, you know, freed slaves and free African-Americans fighting, and, you know, many of these people had freed themselves. They had bolted the plantation. They had organized, you know, thefts and supply lines and things like that to get to Union lines. And they were some of the hardest fighters of the war. And there's a good argument that without their manpower, the Union would have been in a much worse situation, without their courage, frankly. But that gets glossed over in a lot of this. And as a matter of fact, it's only really recently that you've seen some highlighting, in local state publications, things like that, about some of these African-American leaders who organized entire regiments and, provided vital information, you steered ships out of harbors. It's an amazing history, but it was completely ignored straight up because of racism.
Well, yeah, it has a lot to do with something you were talking about in a different context before, like, you guys, your unit is going to transfer out of here, but we're not. And
yes,
you'll read a lot of accounts from officers, some from the upper Midwest, some from New England, who had, for the time, a deep sympathy for the African-American population, whom they often say are their only friends in the South,
yeah,
and their only sources of information. But they went home in 1865. And just like the memory itself of the war, they came into the custody of people who cared to the point of madness, and not in a good way, while everybody else was just sort of hoping they could forget the whole thing.
Well, it's interesting on that front because it took a good 30 years. There were about depending on the part, 15 to 30 years there where, there was real African-American political structures. There were alliances formed between the capital P populace, especially towards the latter end of that period, and Black Republicans. They shot back in a lot of cases, and in some cases they had outside support. For all his faults as a president, Grant knew well how to deal with the KKK, which was you send soldiers in and you shoot them. And many later Republicans didn't have that mentality. So it's weird to see how it lingers for a bit, but also, yeah, starting from 65 on, that abandonment starts to take place. And with each passing year, especially as the business conservatives get more powerful within the Republican Party, they want less and less to do with the project of emancipation. They want to enshrine this, this economic power hold, and the lack of access to what's basically a resurgent Confederate power structure is an impediment to them. And it's not a cause they particularly care about.
I think you and I were talking before about a memoir I read by a Union soldier who's writing in old age in 1909, and he sees the lost cause beginning to triumph because, as you said, it took a long time. And he said, he has this ending chapter, which is basically written in sort of a shrill, bewildered, old curmudgeon tone, like, Jefferson Davis was a traitor. What's going on? Why is there a statue of Henry Wirt, who ran the death camp at Andersonville near this place?
Yeah. And it's interesting because the regimental histories I was mentioning, they were commissioned by the state government, mind you. And that the one I was mentioning earlier about the severe and caustic measures dates from 1901, which was 3 years after North Carolina, the Wilmington coup d'etat, which was basically this alliance of fusionists, they called them at the time, which were capital P populists, but a lot of popularity among the white populations in the eastern and western parts of the state, the same place of the unionist hotbeds. And, you know, the black Republicans, who were still staunch Republican at that point for pretty obvious reasons, had managed to, you know, to start taking over the state government and a lot of local governments. And it was clear that, you know, the ballot box was not a way at that point that the ex-Confederates could win anything back. So starting in Wilmington, but it happened, you know, periodically in some other places too. We, you know, Wilmington, you had this, you know, elected government later called the dispute election, but it's pretty clear that the fusionists won. And the reaction was these segregationist militia just came in and started shooting people. And overnight, Wilmington went from a majority African-American city to a majority white city.
There was no federal response.
No. Okay. No. And that's the problem. By that point, you know, and this is, yeah, for all his faults, Grant helped keep this going a lot longer because there was plenty of local resistance to this. But you had, you know, money and organization and lots of military experience was on the side of the ex-Confederates. And you needed federal support to kind of balance that out. And this is, I think, something Americans really don't like to think about, because it's impossible, especially living in the South, just living in the South with someone who's not, you know, a conservative, Protestant, straight, white dude, basically. The Civil War is a brutal, and the aftermath especially, is a brutal lesson. There's such a thing as too light a peace.
Well, that's an interesting question, because North Carolina has been famous lately, as you've been writing about in your journalist career, for some extremely conservative legislation. Is the memory of the Civil War ever part of the right wing in North Carolina? Is it something they care about but don't mention, or do they just not care that much?
They definitely care about it. They don't like to be seen to care about it too much, though some of them do. And they do the more that they feel under pressure from the kind of societal changes that are going on. North Carolina has always been a battleground. You know, clearly it was a battleground in the Civil War. It's a political battleground now. It's always been in contest. It's not been one of these states like South Carolina where, you know, one side clearly kind of has a stranglehold over everything.
Right.
And so because of that, you know, some of the legislation you're referring to, I mean, it's been down here. It's been kind of interesting because, you know, each day you almost wake to a new federal court ruling saying, no, you can't just, you know, commission a study on what voting methods African-Americans use and then restrict all of those. You can't do that. Like, that's a blatant violation of the Civil Rights Act, for example. You know, one that got pretty famous was HB2, which got tagged as the bathroom bill, and that's, you know, very true. And a lot of us, you know, trans people here, you know, very affected by that. But at the same time, it also in a neat, like, you know, almost proto-Confederate throwback contained stuff against being able to sue in court for discrimination, including racial discrimination in any state court on anything on the job. It included a complete, you know, throw out of any possibility that cities could make their own minimum wage laws or labor protections above and beyond the incredibly minimal amount that North Carolina provides for. So it was kind of like the, you know, oh yeah, remember, we hate you guys, but we hate, you know, we also are racist. We also hate labor and union stuff. You know, it's just in case you've forgotten, we're going to pack it all into one bill and just pass it overnight.
I think just for people who aren't really that familiar with the Carolinas, some are internationalists and so on, can you sort of describe the difference? I think for a lot of people, it's a surprise that there's such a difference between North Carolina and South Carolina, and there is, right? I mean, North Carolina has, as you've talked about, this history of populist agitation, even going before the Revolution, and definitely in the 1890s. You know, with the farmers there, as you said, the fusionists, they hooked up with the black Republicans, and in the war. So, like, what's culturally the difference? And when you grew up, like, how do they talk about South Carolina and North Carolina? Or how do they talk about the different parts of North Carolina?
Well, at the time, and I mentioned this on the Not Safe for Work podcast a little bit as well, and some about talking about some more current political issues. Basically, North Carolina liked to see itself as the same Carolina. And there's some truth to that and some myth to that, but you know, Yeah, we're the sane Carolina, you know, and that even went into some of the, even people who, you know, had this Boston is lost cause BS would be like, oh, well, North Carolina was reluctant to get in the war. We were trying to talk Sandy, but those hotheads down in South Carolina, you know, they just wanted to go for broke. And initially, to you know, to kind of link this to what we were talking about earlier, South Carolina was the only state that did not field a Union regiment from the South. Every other one did. And those vary drastically. You know, you had some in less than, you know, say, Mississippi or Alabama. There's certainly some parts that were more unionist. And you had a significant amount in North Carolina and Tennessee. But it was that gives you some idea. South Carolina has, you know, except for a brief, you know, bright period where, you know, where African American suffrage was, you know, really allowed. It has always been brutally under the lock of one of the worst aristocracies, in this era of history, frankly.
Wasn't there something like a coup by Wade Hampton and his red shirt racist militia in 1876?
Yes. I mean, good Lord, yes.
I mean, that Wade Hampton was, I actually wrote an article once on who should they have hanged? And the first name that entered my head is Wade Hampton. Because he seemed to be getting bigger and better at the end of the war. He seemed completely unkillable. He clearly had no conscience at all. He enjoyed hurting people. He was made to help destroy democracy and multiracial society in South Carolina. And indeed, he created something called the Red Shirts, stealing Garibaldi's perfectly honorable tradition for the name. And as I understand it, he basically initiated the tradition of physically threatening African-American people who tried to vote.
Yes, which sadly has been in the headlines again lately. Which is how current some of this stuff is. Though certainly, Trump isn't doing it with anywhere near the, you know, brutal organizing efficiency that Wade Hampton had, thankfully. But South Carolina, I mean, North Carolina was in contention longer. You know, the Wilmington coup happened in 1898, to give you some idea, at a point where the fusionists were doing really well. And that was really the only resort that, you know, kind of the Wade Hamptonist or the northern variety of them had. But South Carolina has a history of kind of more blatant repression. The stranglehold's been tighter there. North Carolina's always been kind of this back and forth contested state. Though at the same time, it's ironic how, you know, despite that, South Carolina has more unions than North Carolina does, for example. Even North Carolina's reputation of, quote, moderation under this, what were basically, this weird hodgepodge big tent of, you know, of center right and some straight up right wing and centrist kind of Democrats who ran the state for many, many years. They were supposed to be the model of the new South. They were developing a university system. They had a pretty solid public education system for a long time. They were trying to, you know, do development of, you know, rural areas and stuff like that, whereas, you know, South Carolina scorned a lot of those things for a long time. And even into the 60s, the idea was, you know, North Carolina was taking this moderate approach that it was working stuff out. And even when you had things like, you know, Greensboro being a hobbit of civil rights activism, generally the state government didn't do the reactions that you saw in like Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, with some really notable exceptions. But you can see the governors here outside the courthouses shouting, "Your segregation forever."
George Wallace did in Alabama, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so that was the idea, at least. At the same time, this kind of super far right conservatives never really went away.
Jesse Helms.
Oh, good Lord. Jesse Helms. Yeah. Union County, Robert F. Williams had a lot of very militant black resistance around here to what was still a very oppressive society. And yeah, I'm not trying to soft pedal that at all. The same North Carolina was definitely an image. And the only reason it wasn't, you know, that the conservatives like Helms didn't make it as absolutely hellish as South Carolina was that there was just more opposition to doing so. The numbers weren't as favorable here. The history wasn't as favorable here. They still did plenty of horrific stuff. You know, Greensboro was the site of a KKK massacre. in the late 70s, I believe.
I've actually seen the video of that. It's an extraordinary thing. There was some weird left splinter group, and
yeah.
They reminded me of the Maoist group, Revolutionary Communist Youth Brigade, because they would occasionally
storm. Oh, bunch, yeah.
Yeah, they would storm into a classroom with wooden stakes. And at the time, as a sort of weapons-oriented sicko dweeb, I thought, why stakes? You know, either don't bring anything or bring something that would work. Why stakes?
I mean, but some people like Helms are kind of vampiric.
In Greensboro, they actually brought, as I recall, these leftists, brave as hell, stupid as hell, challenged the Klan and brought big wooden sticks.
Yeah.
And with incredible bravery, and this is the 1970s, got shot to pieces.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, with the total complicity of the local power structure.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of a meanwhile, there's a big issue in the loss of the civil rights movement when that's kind of been glamorized, you know, or glamorized, sanctified is a better word for it. And there's a great book written about this. I encourage everyone to read it called This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. It's by Charles Cobb, who's an amazing journalist and was an organizer with the SNCC during that era. There was an understanding that you wouldn't, you know, march in the streets armed. You'd be willing to get attacked, possibly killed, because that was, you know, one of the tactics you're trying to make sure to use to get, you know, some movement towards some basic justice. But if the Klan came to assault your homes, you'd shoot the hell out of them. And, right. You know, many of these households where these civil rights organizers were heavily armed and were not shy about it. And if they were going about their daily lives, were often heavily armed because they'd been fighting the Klan for a long, long time, and you didn't fight them with wooden stakes. Maybe under certain, you know, sorcerous circumstances that might work on Jesse Helms, weird creature that he was, but it's not going to work on the KKK. They're people with guns. And, you know, if the only way for them not to kill you is to shoot back, basically. Right. And that's an undercurrent in the history of the South, including North Carolina. And it stretches back to some of this. Well, we're on our own out here. The federal government isn't coming or not coming for a long time. There's no real support. We have to be a deterrent. But that doesn't fit in kind of the cleaned up history of the civil rights movement succeeding through saintliness rather than, you know, organizing and tactics.
I want to talk to you about that because my only experience of the American South is a failed 2-day interview in Knoxville with U-10 or University of Tennessee. And Knoxville, for that matter, was sort of a union stronghold anyway.
Yes.
So it's not much of a good sample. But how does the Civil War get taught? And is there a sort of sullen resistance? I mean, is it taught as, you know, the war between the states, a neutral struggle that was about states' rights? Or has the fact of slavery as a central issue been accepted? And how do people respond to that?
So it's still, at least when I was coming up, it was still taught as the lost cause bullshit, largely. And it's interesting, it's taught as something which a civil war never is. You have cases with civil wars where you have sides that are varying degrees of reprehensible, and these many civil conflicts. But you can see why people in certain demographics or populations pick one side over the other. And you have some civil wars, like the American Civil War, I'd argue, where despite the whole war as hell aspect, you have, you know, one side that is clearly much more reprehensible than the other. But
you don't have
this all sides are good kind of, or all sides have this understandable, noble thing. There has never been a civil conflict that faced the damn planet where that happened. None of them.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the main war America has, internally is taught like that. So, yeah, I grew up with a fair amount of that stuff. And, you know, I had some kind of counter-program, I guess you could say, from the fact that my family leaned, you know, left of most of the people that were around and remembered some of this stuff. But it had also, there was a lot of stuff against it. And it's interesting that you'll go through some of these, the Confederate flag is starting to come back out around here as it's been clear that, you know, the electoral map is kind of shifting, that the population shifts, that the younger generation doesn't have, you know, is more ardently anti-racist to some degree than their forebears. You're seeing you know, politicians and locals who, you know, years ago would respond to a, you know, pro-equal rights measure on any front, you know, picket labor rights, anti-racist, pro-LGBT rights, and just they say, oh, that's not an appropriate area for government action. And now they've got, like, Confederate and Christian flags flying outside their home, and they're talking about, you know, going into bathrooms with assault rifles. I'm not kidding. You know, this is, yeah, it's this whole, like, pushback against modernity. And to a lot of them, I think it's very tied up with each other. And I think part of, you're seeing part of that played out here. You know, Asheville has a giant monument to Zebulon Vance, the Confederate governor during a good chunk of the war, and one of the architects of Jim Crow afterwards. You know, in the middle of the city right now. And there's been a huge debate over what should happen to it. You know, but it's, and that wouldn't have happened 20 years ago at all. It just been, oh, that's the Vance Monument. I mean, as a matter of fact, when I got here about 10 years ago, I got to Asheville 2 years ago, there were even some local, you know, quote unquote progressives who, you know, said good things about Vance because he didn't hate Jewish people as much as his, like, you know, as the other aristocrats did. And now, you know, Vance is rightly and kind of more widely reviled among, you know, the kind of left-leaning population in Asheville. But there's still a huge debate over what to do with monuments like that, or the fact that one of our main roads is named after Augustus Merriman, who was also a, you know, a major Confederate and an architect, Jim Crow. So you're seeing it play out in kind of these debates. But a lot of the education isn't coming from the school system, where I think it's still very much taught as this, you know, watered down, vague conflict over centralization and decentralization kind of bullshit. You know, certainly you don't get very much about the infighting within the South, the insurgency aspect within the South. And if you do, it's always, oh, look at those, you know, crazy mountain people and their family feuds. You know, any ideological context removed entirely.
Exactly. That's where it blurs into the Hatfield-McCoy tradition, as if those people up in the Appalachians have always been feuding, and the feuding has to do with their weird old Scots-Irish ways, when in fact a lot of those things weren't feuds. A lot of those things were guerrilla warfare between Unionist and pro-Confederate factions, especially along the border.
Exactly. And the fact that people knew each other, you know, doesn't really change that. But if you go to any, you know, kind of Civil War scenario, heck, Syria now, you know, in some of these cities that have broken down block by block, plenty of people shooting at each other know each other. They're still fine to shoot each other. And interestingly, the, you know, the kind of two of the main death squads I mentioned, which are the 64th in the mountains and the 68th around the coast, both of them, and this is really common with death squad type units, were recruited from people from the same area as a lot of people they were shooting.
They were
linked to very different, you know, ties of ideology or ethnicity or affiliation. You know, they were more likely to be linked to the local aristocracy by blood or by, you know, that being the source of their income. Whereas the people who were shooting at them, who were pro-unionists, generally weren't. And this is it's interesting to see that turn on its head to kind of write this stuff off as all those, you know, crazy poor backwards mountain people or coasts who have always been feuding, when really, you know, it's just conflict breaking down the way it always does. You know, people have their attachments, their affiliations that often determines where they end up if things start to break down.
And when you're enforcing a basically sectarian or ethnic war, you need to massacre. So there are going to be massacres. And it's not an exception. It's not an anomaly. It's a basic technique. And you and I were talking earlier about one of the most bizarre and interesting massacres I've read about, which is Nueces in Texas. In the hill country of Texas, of all places, some principled German leftists who fled the failure of the 1848 revolution settled in Texas. That might not have been a good idea, but they absolutely refused to take part in a war to support slavery because they were sort of proto-Marxists and they were not going to have anything to do with that. And they decided to get out of the state of Texas to get to New Orleans, which was already controlled by Union forces. And their neighbors found that. Mm-hmm. And informed the local irregular cavalry. And irregular cavalry is sort of an American euphemism for death squad.
Yeah, along with partisan infantry or scouts,
And they cut them off at the Nueces River and killed them all, some in what was allegedly combat. And the interesting thing when you talk about how the lost cause narrative works in education and in local lore is that I'm reading up on this, and there's this whole section on whether it should be called the Nueces Battle or the Nueces Massacre. And the argument for lost cause Texan neo-Confederates is, well, they did have weapons with them. They did fight back. It's like
they didn't just bare their throats to us. Yeah,
they should have marched across wartime Texas with no weapons. I mean, that is pushing it a bit far, because of course this was Texas units were famous for no quarter, and this was a no quarter battle. If we win, you're all going to die.
That's interesting. You know, I lived in Texas briefly, and there were towns there that still had like German signs, and they were in the hilly, or I'm trying to remember where they were. I just remember driving through thinking, what the hell is that? They're actually like these little villages with German signs everywhere. So, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if that tradition would be continued. I would imagine by now, well, for one thing, Germans merged easily into 19th century America, unlike the Irish, who were either comic relief or just scary wackos. And so by now, I would imagine you probably wouldn't find much of a difference in the political opinions of a German origin Texan or a Texan of a white Texan of other origin. But I don't know. Maybe there is.
Well, and interestingly, you know, one of the I think it was actually by Victoria Bynum, also wrote some books about the Free State of Jones that got folded in the recent movie that was made. But she wrote about some of the Union insurgencies within the Civil War. And her call the Hill Country of Texas had, after the war, what was definitely like a labor, you know, populist, socialist-leaning kind of ferment for a while. And, of course, that got crushed like a lot of
their...
It's where
populism started, right? I mean, the whole movement started there, yeah.
Yeah, see, so yeah, thanks for the correction on that. I'm more familiar with the stuff further east. But yeah, exactly. Like, it's a lot of this stuff does continue, but it doesn't continue forever, sadly. You know, I think the country would be better off if a lot of these, you know, if these, a lot of these Union pockets had, and the ferments they created after the war actually continued and won. But that didn't happen. So the massacre part, the massacre v. battle kind of debate gets to something interesting, which was, while both of these sides were certainly violent, it's a war, and it's a regular war too, but that, and that often gets glossed over as, oh, I'm, you know, these books that, the, you know, I've seen various older books, especially from, you know, 70s, 80s, or way back, you know, the early part of 20th century, say, oh, I'm just going to document the outrages, quote unquote, committed by both sides. But if you look on the Confederate side, it's things like, we massacred this whole community, or we massacred, you know, enough of them to drive them out into an environment like Michelle Moore, where many of them were just going to die. Look on the Union side, it's like, well, this Confederate officer was on leave and they shot him in the head. You know, like, what dastardly people. And which is a totally legitimate move.
They burned property. Can you imagine? Yeah. They burned nice houses, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they burned the nice houses. They stole our supplies. We attacked them and they had actually set up an ambush and killed us first. You know, like, it's that sort of stuff. So while there's certainly a lot of violence here, it's mainly the Confederate side that's carrying out the you know, massacres, the attacks, is carrying out the large-scale death squad stuff.
Absolutely. And in fact, in the early days of the war, the policies that you read about in some of these Union officers' memoirs are almost like a comedy version. In one case, there's a Confederate officer in a Union-conquered town, and he's very proud of his uniform, and he's... walking past these Union soldiers whose job it is to police the town square. So they're dusting their brooms, and they dust his fancy uniforms, and they are actually put in the brig or the military prison for doing this. That's how deeply, in the early years especially, under commanders like Don Carlos Buell, many in the Union officer class were trying to placate the White South.
Yeah. And sadly, some of that continued after the war. I mean, an interesting, and there's, I've read some various parts about this in the Battle Cry of Freedom, which is probably one of the better single volume histories of the Civil War, goes into a little bit. The way that the war and the prolonged contact with the Confederacy radicalized a good, for the time, radicalized a good chunk of the Union Army. especially the rank and file, which is one reason Lincoln was able to hold on to power. And it's interesting because there was a column when the debate over the Confederate flag coming down after Dylann Roof's massacre went on. I remember this column, I think it was in the Washington Post, I have to double check on that, about how they shouldn't, the Jeff Davis and Buell knew better than to politicize the Confederate flag after the war, which is already laughable that someone would say that. And that the Confederacy had an admirable history of civil liberties within its own area, which is also laughable. Wow. They were incredibly, insanely repressive. But they were before the war. There was a Missouri senator, Acheson, who was literally bellowing that we will be compelled to burn, shoot, and hang, sending settlers into Kansas, pro-slavery settlers, with this declaration from a sitting U.S. senator. And that was their mentality. It was their mentality throughout Kansas, the mentality before the war, the mentality during the war. And as soon as they had any chance of doing it, it was the mentality after war. But the Confederacy and their damn flag has always been about violence on behalf of their social system. That is the only thing it's about.
No, and then one of the most glaring examples of that is the fugitive slave law, as in states' rights until you happen to be an escaped slave in Massachusetts, in which case our rights, because we control the Senate, mean that you have to help us bring that slave back.
Yeah, the proposed pro-slavery constitution for Kansas, the first one, straight up said that if you are helping a slave escape, you will be killed. And that if you speak out against slavery, you will be imprisoned. It brings the interesting part about states' rights. States' rights has always been a cover for control by an oligarchy, especially in the South. And this has come up in the recent debates where, the North Carolina's current government is incredibly zealously anti-local control. They try to take local government field water systems, airports. A big part of the HB2 bill was restrictions on any, a local attempt to buff up labor or workplace regulations.
Yeah, let me make sure I understand this, because this, again, sounds like comedy, even though I'm sure it isn't. The city of Asheville decides that it wants to raise the minimum wage so that people can have something like a livable wage, and the state legislature of North Carolina passes a bill saying no city can decide for itself to raise the minimum wage. Only we, the state, get to decide that.
Well, that's very close to what happened, but it wasn't like the city of Asheville decided. Actually, Asheville's political class, despite the elected ones anyway, were somewhat timid about a local minimum wage because it was kind of in some like legal gray territory about where the state powers didn't end. But there was some real foment about it because we have incredibly low wages here, and housing is so unaffordable, we're making national lists about how bad it is. But what happened in this case was Charlotte actually passed a pro-LGBT rights ordinance, adding on to this local ordinance, against racial and religious discrimination that it already had. And so the state legislature goes back, enacts this bill, specifically highlighting parts against trans people, but there's a fair amount in there against gay and lesbian people in general. But they tack onto it kind of a wish list of fuck you to local governments, and that includes a clear prohibition on any local government doing a minimum wage, any of them doing labor regulations past the state, a ban on suing for workplace discrimination in state courts, like the laundry list of just screw you.
So this was originally an anti-LGBTQ law that got mixed up with wages.
And the thing is, that's actually really common as far as the way that the kind of this super far right mentality that's been very present, from the Confederacy on. It kind of tends to conflate its enemies, and not conflate, like lump them together. In the Civil War, the Republicans were black Republicans and free love Republicans, and anything else you want to throw at them, it's not, commie fag didn't get thrown around as an insult for no reason. They kind of lump all this together as the forces they just hate and want crushed, and laws reflect that. Thing was, though, a lot of people from outside the state said, they kind of were like, well, isn't this hypocritical? The Republicans in the South are local control and states' rights, they're clamping down local governments. But it's actually not contradictory at all, because, and you see this in the Civil War too, they were big on, when they say states' rights, they literally mean the state house. Local governments, you know, can eventually, you know, enough local people, and you see this in some of the labor stuff in the 1800s, will say, wait a minute, you guys are assholes. We're electing a sheriff who's, say, not going to evict people, or will, you know, be pro-union, for example, either in the capital U or later on the lowercase U sense. Local governments can be kind of temperamental. And the federal government, despite its many massive problems, you know, has so many populations to respond to as the electorate widens that occasionally it'll, you know, respond to these local outrages by, say, under Grant, sending in troops or passing these laws that are not to, you know, kind of your local oligarch's interest. But the state house is kind of the Goldilocks of, like, local oppression. It's right. Just, you know, it's just right for, like, for a, you know, kind of this planter class to have a ton of control. And that's why they've been harping on it, you know, in the Civil War as a way to preserve slavery. And they're very blatant about that connection at the time. And even now where, you know, people say, oh, such and such a libertarian had it. Well, they're against federal drug laws. But if you look at what they're saying, they are totally in favor of state houses being able to take away any damn right they please.
Exactly. This always bothered me about the Ron Paul fixation by people who wanted to end the war on drugs. Ron, their attitude was, oppression and tyranny is only when Washington prevents a state from tyrannizing its population. It's not
exactly.
Tyranny if the state government tyrannizes its population. As far as the Ron Paul people were concerned, states could hang people for smoking weed,
yep.
And that's fine. It's just that the Washington should not tell them, you know, whether to legalize or not legalize. That's tyranny.
And that's got a very old history. You know, it's the wine of the aristocracy in America, because that was the state houses where they had a ton of power. They had a ton of power going back, you know, even to before the founding of the country and that institution. Other institutions were a lot dicier for them to hold, or could go in some very unexpected directions. But state houses, they're always pretty firmly entrenched in. And you see that in the Civil War, in the rationales of the Confederacy. You see it after the war, you know, oh, voting rights go up to states, or, you know, we can ban you even speaking against slavery before the war. There was no idea that the state house had any constraint on it. That was very intentional because they wanted to be as repressive as possible of any of these forces they saw against them. And that can be straight in the, you know, 20s, 30s, 60s. You know, states' rights is not some, like, big thing about, oh, we're just going to, you know, decentralize the government because we vaguely believe it's a better thing to do. They do that because it gives them more power to be racist and crush you the way they don't like. That's the only reason for it.
Right. Well, Missouri in 1861 is one of the more remarkable examples of this. Basically, the governor and the planter elite assumed that the state would vote for secession. It didn't. It didn't even come close to voting for secession. So basically, they seceded from the state, and they said, the vote is illegitimate. The people who voted against secession are illegitimate, and they set up this incredibly complicated and very Syrian. You know, this is when you read about Missouri, when you read about these places, it's like American exceptionalism vanishes. This is just classic irregular warfare stuff. There were two legislatures in Missouri, one siding with the Federals, moving away from federal control and committing a lot of massacres in favor of something that the voters had just plain rejected at state level.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was incredibly common, too, after the Wilmington II, where, you know, at that time the state structure was, you know, was held by the fusionists, or a lot of it was. You see, you know, this you know, crushing of voter turnout, this, you know, crushing of the rules that ostensibly are supposed to govern the state. And the next state constitution, you know, obviously includes a whole bunch of your typical horrific Jim Crow racist bans, but it also reintroduces massive property requirements for the franchise. I mean, they knew exactly what they were doing here, and they were very blunt about the time. That's kind of the thing that gets me, too, is that the lost cause narrative doesn't stand, and it's, you know, kind of political inheritors, even like kind of the state's rights, you know, code libertarian people. It doesn't have any scrutiny whatsoever. It's not even like an arguable case you can make that I might personally disagree with or think is not as persuasive as another case. You know, this was a cause that went into the war loudly declaring its allegiance to slavery. And it's and you know, it's a view that anyone who was working for a living was a mudsill and was, you know, not worthy of holding a Southern gentleman's coat, crap like that.
And this is where another one of your interests intersects in a really with the memory of the Civil War in a way that was actually too bizarre for me to follow. I mean, a lot of the right-wing science fiction that you talk about is very familiar to me, and you know, and some of it, I'm not going to stop reading Jack Vance just because he would probably creep me out politically. There's too much fun in reading Jack Vance, so that's just how it goes. But then there's
I adore Jack Vance.
Yeah, then there's this guy. I think his name is Harry Turtledove.
Oh God!
With some time travel story about the South African army,
the guns of the fucking South. That's I fucking hate it. That book. Sorry. Pardon my French, but I know it'll be totally accessible listeners.
Yeah, because this is where the science fiction nerd demographic overlaps with the neo-Confederate demographic in a way that was just too wild for me. Like, wait a minute. I know how to read science fiction. I get about 50 pages into the first of these books, and I'm thinking, no, you're not seriously saying these are our late 20th century white South African apartheid officers training up Confederate soldiers
with AK-47.
Of the AK-47, are you? And it's like, I go a few paragraphs later and I realize, you know, that's what you're doing. And then that's where I flung the book across the room. It's like, hey, I'll take a lot, but that is just weird. And yet that was a very popular series, wasn't it?
No. As a matter of fact, I actually, in my misspent youth, read the whole goddamn book. And it gets even worse from there because inevitably, you know, Turtledove can't have just these South African Nazis, you know. So eventually, you know, they become more and more ominous. And, you know, the noble Robert E. Lee, which, you know, that's probably worth a whole show in its own right about how much of a myth that is, you know, can't stand, you know, and thinks that they're creepy and evil. And eventually
I want to hear a little bit of the debunking of the noble Robert E. Lee, even just 1 minute of this.
Lee was your typical planter class shit. He was a tactically and strategically brilliant planter class shit. Except for his incredibly muddled orders, which, you know, those of us on the more union side of things should be thankful for. But, you know, he inherited some slaves. He didn't let them go for a long time. He worked them for money. I even heard the idea growing up from people who, you know, in a time with more things like the internet would have probably known a little better. Even people who were fairly left-leaning had this myth that, you know, Lee was the one good person in the Confederate power structure,
right.
Which is...
I remember totally that crap. Really well. Because he has that expression of suffering when you see his portrait, as if, I don't want to be doing this. I don't want to be massacring 300,000 loyal American troops. I just sort of have to because of, you know, my loyalty to Virginia or... first of all, the concept of loyalty to Virginia is a little hard for me to grasp, but that's
same.
But the idea that I was just reading this bitter Union soldier's memoir from 1909, and he says quite bitterly, Robert E. Lee wrote a letter to his son in 1861, March 1861, saying secession is anarchy. Robert E. Lee was never so much as a road supervisor in Virginia. His entire career, and this is something you see a lot with this libertarian demographic, his entire career was with the federal government. He was in a time when the federal government was quite small. He was a federal employee.
And when the army was particularly small. It's an interesting kind of dynamic, too. And you see this actually in aristocracies as a whole, especially later on in the Victorian era. You see it with the Irish peers or the Scottish peers or whatever. They will be, you know, they'll spend most of their time in the capital or, you know, as part of this power structure. And then, you know, when their crofters go on strike or, you know, their industrial interests unionize, all of a sudden they'll become deeply concerned about their local ties in a place they've, like, visited maybe twice in their life. And because it's where the money is. They'll go back and where the power is, and they'll go back to defend it. And that's very much my personal take on what happened with Lee. Most of his noises are this, like, vague holdover from the Jeffersonian, well, slavery's kind of bad, but that's not going to stop me from, you know, committing rape, selling off my slaves, you know, participating in it fully to the absolute horrific detriment of, you know, of thousands of human beings. There's a horror in that level of hypocrisy, you know. The Forrest and Wade Hansons of the world are horror, too. But they're a whore that's very blunt about being a whore.
Hampton and Forrest just say, we're monsters. Deal with it. If you don't like monsters, stay away. But Lee has this I'm a pained expression in every portrait you ever see of him is like, I'm afraid I'm going to have to train some batteries of grape shot on your people over there. I wish this hadn't happened, but here we go.
Yeah, well, and it falls down further when, you know, his army, while invading into the North, enslaved free African Americans. He didn't really stop that, or even the idea that, you know, he was a father to his men or some horse shit like that. His army had the worst casualty rate in the damn war, hands down, because all those Napoleonic charges took an obvious Napoleonic toll when you add, you know, rifles and modern artillery in the mix. So, you know, from top to bottom, his other than him being, you know, a strategic and tactical genius at a number of points, his reputation just simply does not hold up, especially of him being any sort of like secret liberal within the Southern power structure. He never was.
Right, right. Yeah, and yet, you know, there were Virginians who were arguably better generals too, like George Thomas, who choose the Union.
And weren't traitors, yeah.
We're not traitors, and it takes a long time to find out about George Thomas. I think he's just beginning to get some notice, but this entirely admirable man who I didn't really hear about growing up. I mean, Robert E. Lee was kind of like the misguided saint, and even among Northern sympathizers, of whom I was one in this imbecilic way, had this feeling that he was doing it under duress and under some genuine conviction.
Oh, if only he'd been on our side, yeah, the nobility kind of myth. Yeah, I heard it growing up, too. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't come across when you read about his early adventures in Western Virginia, though. He doesn't come across as a particularly good officer there. It's only when he's on his own ground that he really seems to come into his own. Every time he moves off it, things get very tricky. But yeah, the Lee myth is remarkable in that way, and the fact that you don't hear about Thomas. Of course, I mean, Thomas had his own enemies in his own army who saw to that. Grant is a great narrator, and he hated Thomas. But there was this feeling, as someone pointed out on Facebook, that the whole thing was just a tragedy. It was just one of those things, but it was all misunderstanding. As someone pointed out on Facebook, there used to be something called the Blue and Gray Bowl. It was like one of those corrupt college all-star games, right? Where they figured we can get our own bowl and our own bowl income if we divide the players by North and South. And it was like NFL style reenactment of the Civil War, with as if there were no morality involved.
God, I remember that. That's, I totally forgot about that. What, and I wonder when it ended. That's interesting. I'm going to look into that.
Well, and it's this trope that keeps coming up when power is just discussed between elites, and it's not just, you know, not just with the issues stemming from the Civil War, with a lot of other issues. Oh, this must be a misunderstanding. If only we could all communicate properly. And one of the big gaps here is that on the, you know, you even had that BS, like you mentioned, with the soldiers and the brooms and the dust during the middle of, you know, the Civil War itself. Whereas, you know, if you were on the ground in Madison County, if you were, you know, Abraham Galloway, as the escaped slave that rallied whole units and has this incredible career that should be its own movie but hasn't become one for obvious reasons, you know, or Harriet Tubman's raids, for example, you have this, you know, no one had, or the Great Dismal Swamp Maroon raids, no one had that luxury. Right. You know, the local power service was corrupt. It always been corrupt. It probably wanted you dead or subjugated. There wasn't a fucking conversation here. One of you was going to win and the other one wasn't. And that's how power plays out in the ground in pretty much every part of the world. America is definitely no exception in that. But it is something that, you know, people who like this stuff to be genteel, even pretend it's genteel, even when it's absurd as, you know, hey, we're going to go shoot each other in the morning, still have this, you know, myth of gentility about it, really like to peddle that. And you even see that, you know, God help us, every election season, you know, of, oh, if only we could all communicate, we could certainly work all these terrible issues out. And the Civil War puts a lie to that in a way I think a lot of Americans don't like to think about.
Well, and I think a lot of it comes from the ambiguity, which has been imposed over time, the false ambiguity, because it wasn't ambiguous then, about the cause of the Civil War. I mean, there's so much revisionism that came out when I grew up that it was actually not about slavery, that the North didn't care about slavery, the South didn't care. It was all about states' rights and stuff. I mean, I've just popped up here, you know, the Declaration of Causes by Texas. And this is typical
of
all the Declaration of Causes. I'll just read like a little bit here from paragraph three. This is where Texas officially explains why it's seceding and joining the Confederacy. She was received as a Commonwealth holding into the Confederacy, maintaining and protecting the institution known as Negro slavery, the servitude of the African to the white race within her limits, a relation that had existed from the first settlement for wilderness by the white race and which her people intended should exist in all future times. And then down below in their grievances, it says here, in all the non-slaveholding states, they're complaining about the slaveholding states, an unnatural feeling of hostility to these southern states and their beneficent and patriarchal system of African slavery, proclaiming the debasing doctrine of the equality of all men, irrespective of race or color, a doctrine at war with nature, in opposition to the experience of mankind, and in violation of the plainest revelations of the divine law. That's what they said themselves were the reasons why they seceded.
I think my favorite moment like that, I wish that should be engraved in every history book, because it spells it out so clearly about the system they were trying and kept trying to, and in some, you know, mutated ways are still trying to prop up. I think my favorite moment was in the middle of the war, when there's this whole diplomatic fight going on between the Confederacy and the U.S. over trying to get Britain to, you know, break the blockade. There's a point where because the slavery part isn't that popular in the UK at the time for its own, you know, mythological reasons, and for also some genuine revulsion from, you know, the early popular and union movements there. But it's the Confederate diplomats are trying to finagle this thing of, oh, you know, we're just about local control and rising up for our rights. And some of the richer newspapers catch wind of this, and they start spelling out in capital letters, basically a fuck you to the diplomat. No, this is still about slavery. It's always been about slavery. Why the hell are you fighting if it's not about slavery? You know, and that's that. You can't have a blunter rebuttal to the idea that it was about anything else. And the system attached to that is why you see a lot of this resistance, because, you know, John C. Calhoun, for example, who was the architect of a lot of the early kind of proto-Confederacy system and pioneered this, you know, nullification states' rights BS a lot of libertarians still cling to, straight up said that to expand the plantation system, you should evict, quote, rogues, I believe was the term he used, or unproductive, you know, settlers off of their land to make way for more plantations.
That's one of the strangest things about the Civil War to me. And I understand this is a typical, horrible, sectarian, messed up war, and those things generate a lot of weirdness. But the open contempt that so many Southern officers express in their letters for the white trash or mudsills who form their units is really extraordinary. I think there's one letter in which one of them says both those things, like, these people are far less civilized than the house Negroes of my household. I despise even looking at their slatternly women outside their cottages with the tobacco drooling down their lips. And then he adds, after a paragraph break, and yet they make our breasts soldiers. Oh, well, what are you going to do?
Well, it's kind of this classic, you know, it's an interesting holdover on this thing. And there's, people have written about the influence that craft writers like Walter Scott had in all this, with this kind of, you know, feudal throwback mentality. I don't think necessarily the planter aristocrats, even the more recent additions to the ranks, you know, the kind of jumped up nouveau riche types, ever really lost that. You know, it's like, you know, yeah, you'll have some fondness for these guys the way you would for a hunting hound if they're serving you. And otherwise, what do? You shoot a dog down if it's not useful to you, was that mentality at least. Which is interesting now that, you know, you see like these, you know, bigger and bigger Confederate flags in some areas, like right around where I'm, you know, speaking to y'all from right now, or God forbid in places like West Virginia. And I have met some people up here, you know, including some older people, who were like, what kind of heritage are they talking about? People flying that flag were busy killing my ancestors. But it's this neat kind of historical myth that's been built up when, yeah, they did despise them. And that's one reason why, you know, an actual map of the Civil War and the areas where the Confederate regime, which I think is a good term for it, really controlled stuff would look a lot like something like Syria. You'd have these, you know, pockets where they had pretty firm control, and pockets where, yeah, you could go if you brought 100 guys with guns with you, and pockets where, you know, no, you have, you know, this enemy militia moving around and it's joining this other militia and it's cooperating with federal forces. It would look a lot more like that than like the kind of firm, all these states went to the Confederacy and these states went to the Union.
How much did the economy, this may be too much of an abstract question, I don't know, but how much did the economy, local economy, influence how much sort of pro-unionist or pro-Confederacy among the poor whites? Like, if there were a lot of small farmers and not really large, were they more, for example, you know, in West Carolina, were they more pro-unionist or did that not play in as much?
Well, like a lot of things, you know, these ethnic and sectarian and economic identities all intersect and overlap. But it did play a major role, of course. It always does. And, I mentioned earlier that a lot of the death squad commanders were low-level aristocrats or wannabe aristocrats. And that's a pretty clear indication. If the people who had affiliations with a larger economic structure, which was, you know, heavily based on slavery, even the areas where, you know, where it might not have had huge numbers of slaves, like the western and northeastern parts of North Carolina, you were still tied into that economy. And the people you need to curry favor with, you know, were definitely probably even more tied into that economy. And it's, you know, even the areas that weren't quote unquote slaveholding, like West North Carolina, the power figures, the big judges, the senators, people like that usually had some level of slaves, and many of them had hundreds. That's very much tied into it. And it's interesting to read Leave to the War, especially with the Mudfill Commons and other stuff, and how kind of cold-bloodedly perceptive a lot of the early Confederates were about this. This isn't a fact that's highlighted much, but a lot of the very early education infrastructure legislation for the country passed right after secession happened because it had been held up for years. And basically the idea, I've, you know, heard it said different ways by different kind of Confederates, or read it said different types of kinds of Confederates, was that a government that can build a canal, a government that can, you know, build a school, a public school, and can take your slaves. And that, right. And the Confederate Constitution includes a pretty clear bar to, like, major public infrastructure. Yes. And there's a weird clarity about that, because as long as the roads run from the plantation, as long as, you know, you are people around you, especially these, you know, people that you might have kicked their grandfather off the land to make room for said plantation, have to come to you to eat or to get any gainful employment or any economic or social prospects, you have a huge amount of power. The second that, you know, the state government or, God forbid, the federal government, even a local government, starts to open a schoolhouse or, you know, offer them some sort of other job or other identity, your grip on power becomes very tenuous. And that's – so, yeah, the economic side overlapped and intersected very neatly with, you know, the racial and – I mean, literally, say in the text, the patriarchal kind of dimensions of this.
Yeah, you know, I was just reading a passage in one of these memoirs, because I'm addicted to Civil War memoirs. They help in some way. And there's this regiment from Michigan or Wisconsin or some very upstanding state. They often have a lot of Germans in them, you know, and they believe in public education. And they're marching through Alabama, and they come to this shack, and on the shack is a sign that says Central Academy, and they just burst out laughing, and they say, if that's a Central Academy, what does an ordinary schoolhouse look like? And basically, as the author says, there aren't any ordinary schoolhouses. That's not part of the culture at all. And he says, this would be a great state if it just had more free schools and free men.
And that divide was very, very, very much there. And interestingly, a lot of the Southerners who became Unionists, who were the more prominent political leaders, had ties to that sort of the pre-war debate. And you especially see it in states like North Carolina or Tennessee, where you didn't have as large of a slave economy, and there was some political contestation, was, you know, people were like, well, maybe we should get some industry and maybe some public infrastructure, or maybe some schools. That might be a really good idea. And the, you know, more diehard guys who are like, nope, nope, that's an unacceptable government intrusion. Forcing people in other states to return our slaves, not an unacceptable government intrusion, meaning that there's a road that doesn't run through my plantation. Fuck you, you know. And it's, and actually, like Sam Houston, who was a unionist and refused to side with the Confederacy, was known through his career in Tennessee and then later on in Texas, trying to actually make some headway on this. And you know, you can see his speeches. He keeps harping, we need public schoolhouses. We need, ways for poor, the impoverished to get some education. And it was just not popular among the Confederate aristocrats, ended up forming a good part of Texas. They didn't want to hear it.
What's interesting about that is that their explicit ideology was racial, but there's a lot of this that is not racial. And occasionally you'll see them say they much prefer the company of basically their house slaves to that of the white trash.
Well, I think the thing that is consistent is inequality. And so so long as you have inequality of race around you everywhere, it sort of gets everybody prepared for inequality of wealth as a permanent thing too. That's how I see it.
Like I said, all this collides and intersects, as does in every single social system. You can't go over to Syria and talk about Sunni and Shia in a simple manner. There's divisions within them, of course, and divisions regionally. And it's very similar in this way. I mean, they had a weirdly cohesive view of this very feudal aristocracy. And part of the extension of that, in a feudal aristocracy, you don't generally just have two classes. You intentionally have multiple ones, probably so you can play them off against each other. And because why they refer the company to their slaves, and especially when you read slave memoirs after the war, or even some of the ones who escaped before the war, they're fond of people who are hating them the entire time, who are, as soon as they are given the opportunity, plot against them, who even when it was hopeless in a number of cases, outright violently rose up against them and tried to kill them as quickly and as some as painfully, understandably, as possible.
Yeah.
But those are the people they're fond of because they can't outwardly resist, because they can do anything they want. It's the reason why, even the worst kind of well-off aristocrat in the current days will express, this weird fondness for their employees as long as they don't have any minds of their own. Heck, there was a tweet from one of Trump's sons recently about, how they love the loyalty of this guy who wouldn't attend the family wedding because he was working for them. They like that sort of fondness and quote unquote connection.
It's like Henry Ford, adoring and paying his workers well. And then the minute they started striking, you just had them shot,
it's throughout this, along with the insane reactions. There's really no other way to put them of the Confederates to what was to the election of a president who said, look, we shouldn't extend slavery anymore. And eventually we need to roll it back. And that provoked, this absolutely paranoid, violent uprising. And the fickleness and the sensitivity of an aristocracy, that even the smallest curb on its power it regards as this, affront to liberty. And you see that, it fortunately in less organized, less numerous, less violent ways with, the libertarians right now, but and a fair amount of conservatives. But you see it back then even more blatantly, like with the Texas Declaration. They're not hiding it back then because they don't have to. So, the very possibility that they might not have, the literal term used was an empire for slavery. These guys just didn't want to keep their own turf. They wanted to expand throughout the U.S. and into other countries. They're very blunt about that, too. Even the idea of the slightest curb on that, some point in the future, by some political regime they didn't totally control, was like a let's go shoot people level offense. And
there's some strange adventures there. I mean, they keep proposing Cuba because it's as if the planter class knows that this is going to end rather badly one of these days unless we can distract these people who have a preponderance of industry and population and immigration and just about everything else. So how about Cuba? And we can have Cuba as a slave state. It's pretty much sort of a slave state already, and it would suit us fine. Or the extraordinary Walker expedition to Nicaragua. I mean, there's always some interest in...
Remember the one where he got garroted?
I forget how he ended. But he
or shot by a firing squad. It ends in some bloody way.
Yeah,
for him.
He ended in an inappropriate manner, at any rate. And there's always this attempt. Well, which you could argue was part of the Mexican War as well, to let, as Sherman said about the young men of the South, let out a little of their hot blood somewhere else, because they knew that if that was not done, it was going to be let out in the place where it was finally happening.
Walker was killed by the firing squad, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was I can't remember. It was one of the other filibusters, which is ironically where that term comes from. That was garroted because you get this interestingly with how the internationalism overlaps with the Union supporting Benito Juarez in Mexico and the Confederates, especially after the war, later supporting the remains of the French imposed kind of Habsburg monarchy. Speaking of weird tales, there.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this kind of like this sense of like, you know, super conservative adventurism. And it generally at a certain point, the Latin American countries' populations just were not screwing around. You know, when these expeditions, they just slaughtered them. It's basically a don't come back. What happened? Well, we took one of your dandies and we garroted them to death. We shot a bunch of the other ones. You stay in your plantation houses and, you know, oppress your own people.
One of the comic figures of the war in a horrendous way is General Sterling Price. And as I recall, General Sterling Price, and by the way, I was a Portis fan. It didn't occur to me what it meant that Rooster Cogburn's cat is named General Sterling Price. But anyway, General Sterling Price, who was a really incompetent general and a bastard in all kinds of other ways, attempted to flee to Mexico, I think, and offer his services to Mexico. But like a lot of would-be right-wing emigres, he found that people are weird once you get outside the U.S., and he didn't like it there. And I think he came back and sulked until he died.
I think you mentioned him in your, the Confederacy should have hanged article as an example of someone you probably should have let run around for a while, that you probably should have let live.
Yeah, he was such a fool. Yeah, but I imagine, and again, Portis is a touchstone for me to this because, as I say, I didn't grow up in the South as you did, and for me, Portis's novels are where you get the sense of how people in the neo-Confederate tradition see these things. I mean, Cogburn is a veteran of Quantrill's brigade, which was despised even by regular Confederate units who committed the bloodiest of the many raids on Lawrence, Kansas in 1863 and was just a psychopath anyway, who never had much interest in Confederate politics until he realized it was a great way to kill people without penalty. Cogburn gets into an argument with the Texas Ranger and they get into an argument about Lawrence, Kansas, and Cogburn says there was a lot of lies told about that. And you get the feeling that Charles Portis, who, I have to repeat, writes some of the greatest dialogue in American literature, grew up with a sort of secret family tradition that Quantrill was right. Those guys were right.
Yeah, I mean, just the same as I was getting stories from my grandfather much later, obviously, about, the devil still got that particular death squad member. That was still an injustice, over a century later, well over a century later at that point. These things linger. And you mentioned earlier the sci-fi part of it, the abundance of, hey, let's find ways the Confederacy could win in alternate history.
Yes, very much, right.
Yeah, it's probably like, I'm wildly overestimating here probably, but it seems like it's 70% of the damn genre. And there's so many more interesting things you could do with it. And it's, let's look at another way that a more reactionary causes than did win could have won. And could have won in a more brutal fashion. And, let's go to some really convoluted links. And it shows up as weird spots in sci-fi. John Campbell, who's this, famous sci-fi editor, one of the founders of the genre, and even gets praised by a lot of liberal writers, would go to extraordinary lengths to justify why slavery wasn't actually that bad.
Yeah.
It was, a regular thought experiment he would do, quote unquote. And lo and behold, he shows up dismissing a lot of the work of the early African-American writers who are starting to gain traction in the 50s and 60s. and again and again, we'll print people who basically want to figure a way with, you know, technology or states to bring back these really reactionary social structures at a time when when they're under siege in modern society.
Well, yeah, that brings up the big question: where is all this going? And that's kind of a huge rather than big question. But I mean, we've alluded a couple of times to a movie that unfortunately none of us has been able to see called Free State of Jones. I did read the book, and Eileen Jones reviewed the movie. And for this is actually a major Hollywood film in which mixed race insurgents against the Confederacy, who assassinate Southern officers, are portrayed, at least in the book, I can't vouch for the movie, in a positive manner. Newton Knight is portrayed in a very positive manner. So I don't is this changing?
Slowly. And I think you've seen that, for example. I mean, if you'd asked me 10 years ago if South Carolina would ever take the Confederate flag off its capital, I would have, I would have laughed, frankly. And you are seeing, I think, a more, partly because, like with North Carolina's gerrymandering, which they've done, tried to do at the state, local, and congressional levels and have been hit by the federal courts and all of those at this point, there's this attempt to cling to power when the numbers are just increasing and the societal changes at large is increasingly against you. And while there's, I'm at the older end of the millennial generation, while there's still plenty of, kind of problematic political views and among my peers, in general, there is a little less tolerance for lost cause on the whole. There's a little more openness to, why aren't there stories of, of Harriet Tubman's raid? Why aren't there stories of all these, other parts of the war you've ignored? Instead of another thing about, noble Confederate dandies, fighting nobly, or, and I'm thinking of, you mentioned Eileen Jones earlier. She wrote an amazing essay on the way that the film has propped up kind of the Confederate lost cause. I think it's fading, and I see that. But like I mentioned earlier, it's kind of in that really vicious part of these things fading, where, people who just kind of make noises about, local control and states' rights and, inappropriate government action about various, civil or economic rights measures earlier are now, hoisting Confederate and Christian flags and becoming very blatant about their rhetoric because their sense is that their back is to the wall. You're even seeing that in this election, despite the, numerous, problems in the Democratic coalition, Georgia is being talked about as a serious swing state. That was also pretty unthinkable for a long time, at least for the last like 30 years or so.
Georgia voting for Hillary Clinton is mind-blowing if it happens. It really is.
Well, yeah, and I think it has less to do with Hillary Clinton's case than the larger changes that have gone on within that state. And thus why it's now, toxic ground, more toxic ground than it was before for someone like Trump, who has pretty blatantly, more so than any Republican, in a long, long time, or any conservative candidate in a long, long time, kind of sided with and coddled and encouraged kind of this, pro-Confederate mess. I just, saw on Twitter earlier, and I've seen numerous times of those campaigns using Trump flags, or not Trump flags, they might be called that in later era, Confederate flags at Trump rallies. Yeah, add a big T to the stars and bars or something, But Confederate flags at Trump rallies, being sold outside the rallies, being taken to the rallies, and that doesn't surprise me one bit. But it's that whole kind of dying beast syndrome in politics. It may have a spear in it, but damned if it's not going to fight back pretty hard first because it's used to winning. And it regards any small curb as, like, for example, a city passing, in this case, Charlotte passing that ordinance, as, a reason to convene the state legislature and crush it immediately. Like, that's, even with less gunfire, that's still kind of the mentality. So I think we're probably in for, in a lot of ways, and this is not just on this front, but a lot of others, probably the most prolonged period of upheaval since the late 1800s, as far as American politics goes. But I think, part of that is because more of the tide is against kind of this reactionary mindset than before. The terrain is a lot less favorable. And so it senses that it is far more under threat, and it's reacting with, the ensuing amount of kind of force and insanity.
Well, I guess one question that comes to mind, and I'm the one who hasn't lived in America for a long time, so I ask this in honest ignorance, is why does the American right need the Confederacy as a good memory? Couldn't it get by perfectly well without that? I mean, couldn't it drop the lost cause and still get the stuff it really cares about?
Well, what Even part does it really care about? Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, and some of them do. But, I mean, it was interesting, you know, over I first voted in the 2000 election, so, you know, around my turn 18. And I remember the attempts during the Bush years by the business conservatives, who ironically have been, the until this political season, the only faction of the Republican Party to be there the entire time. They started as Northern Business Conservatives and just became more kind of generalized business conservatives as the decades went on. They, you know, people like Rove were saying, we need maybe to dial back the blatant, like, reactionary social conservatism and reach out, you know, some Hispanic voters, you know, do some immigration reform, albeit very tilted towards kind of corporate interests style of immigration reform. You know, they weren't, like, listening to any left-wing Latino groups there. But just, you know, reading the writing on the wall as far as the demographic and social changes that were going on. And I remember, you know, when they tried to press forward with a very watered-down version of, you know, very conservative immigration reform, and a huge chunk of their party revolted because they really like racism. Yeah. They really, you know, they're, when it comes down to it, these things are not separable for them. You know,
because that's the real motive power. In fact, yes, yes, that makes a lot of sense to me, because I read a lot of right-wing websites with an odd fascination, and at places like Red State, they're outraged because they honestly thought that something about something like half of the American population shared their deadly serious libertarian and other pedantic views. And now Trump comes along and exposes the fact that this has a lot more to do with a simple visceral hatred, and that they are a tiny minority and they don't know what to do. And then you get these, then you get these articles in National Review, which express open hatred for the people that they've been using as voters now that they feel deserted.
Yeah, well, yeah, very much so. And that's, and, you know, and this is one of the things I was mentioning earlier back in the Civil War about how, economics played a major role, and so did racism, so did, you know, this kind of feudal patriarchal mentality of all these things colliding. They collide today, too. I remember, I grew up not that far from where Pat Robertson and then a little farther out, Jerry Falwell were based. And of course, that's the religious fundamentalist side. And I think if you compile, you know, racist / nationalist fundamentalist and business conservatives, you've got basically the three main factions of the conservative movement at this point. And they overlap with certainly some. But the degree to which, you know, people like Falwell would conflate, you know, racial segregation, their idea of religious traditionalism, patriarchy, God forbid, plenty of hatred of you know, anyone who wasn't straight, and like economic conservatism, you know, the anti-unionism, anti-labor sort of thing. These things were all very much like part of their kind of ideological universe.
This is something I wanted to ask you, because it's something that I've never seen taken seriously. But if you spend your time looking at nightmare wars like this, as I do, you start to wonder, isn't there a sectarian dimension to this civil war too? Isn't there a kind of major difference between the Christianity of New England and the Christianity of the South, so that even though they officially share the same religion, there's something really there's something almost like an enemy relationship between Congregationalism and Southern Baptists?
It gets complicated. As a matter of fact, one of the clearest markers of the unionism in this area, for example, and also where I grew up, that's still around, even after Lost Cause, you know, try to whitewash and bury so much of this over, especially as a lot of people who aren't unionists weren't, you know, hideously wealthy usually and didn't, you know, leave behind these, weren't in a position to leave behind these long, florid, well-published accounts, you know, of justifying their actions afterwards. It's the split in churches. There are bunches of churches in West Carolina, East Carolina, you can still trace where they split to the 1860s or the early 1850s. And it was so there were some of that where, like, these people were both technically Baptist or, you know, some variety of Protestant, Methodist, what have you, but they still split over slavery, over secession. But you also had some denominations that were, you know, I mean, you know, the 1840s and 50s, you have reports of Unitarians, of all people, you know, behind battering rams and shooting at federal marshals to free slaves. You know, they were to some degree the shock troops of abolitionism and of these various, you know, kind of more New England denominations. But those, a lot of those had Southern branches as well. Quakers, for example, were all over the South. Right. And you get this part where, you know, you may have a band of deserters who are as Baptist as, you know, as anyone they've been deserting from or shooting, or the home guard they've been shooting at.
Right.
But they'll, you know, say, and contrary to, you know, kind of the Cold Mountain mythology, deserters usually broke off in, you know, bands or even whole units sometimes, because that's
Cold Mountain, their job is to invent bluegrass music, but how they actually spend their time.
Exactly. The truth is a lot closer. You know, you reading a report in Syria, which we keep using analogy, but it holds up in a lot of ways because it's right in the limelight right now, of, you know, oh, look, this militia, you know, was with some part of the Free Syrian Army, but then ISIS and al-Nusra have screwed them over, so now they're with the Syrian Democratic Forces. You know, it's much more of, you know, oh, they deserted. Well, they deserted, you know, bands ranging from like 15 to 500 strong. But there's a, you know, number of points in the Western state where, or not West state, the Western part of the state, where, you know, a part of the home guard on these death squad units will basically come upon some deserters who are usually armed, still keeping some loose form of military discipline, sentries, that sort of thing. And attack them. And off, you know, it's interesting how many times they're being hidden by like Quakers. You know, they'll be put up in the local Quaker meeting house or by a Quaker family. You know, in the middle of the state with Mennonites and sects like that. That, but at the same time, the people they're putting up couldn't have told you the difference between their religion and the religion of the people they were fighting, other than they thought they were wrong.
That's a good point. Like Newton Knight and his people are in fact classic Southern Baptists. I remember that because one of the things mentioned in the book is that there's so much hatred left over after the war that even when he's in his 70s, he gets accused of being an N-word loving traitor or something at church and attacked by this guy in his 20s, and he figures this isn't a fair fight, so he slits the guy's throat.
And then the Confederates, you know, they're the pro-Confederates, you're like, what an outrage, he slashed this poor young man's throat, you know, like it's that kind of bully mentality of, oh my god, you fought back and you may have fought back successfully, how dare you, you know.
Yeah, and yeah, he was just as devout a Southern Baptist as anybody else. I mean, if anything, it's more that the Southern churches seems to have held their cohesion, whereas the longer I stayed in the academic world in places like Berkeley, the more I felt that I was among people who would have been clergy a couple of generations earlier.
You're probably pretty accurate on that, yeah.
And have become some sort of secular variant on it.
John, but, you have here a bit about, I mean, to kind of flip it on its head, about areas in the Union with Confederate sympathies for different reasons, right? I don't know if you want to talk like the Copperhead.
Yeah, well, yeah, that gets very Trumpy. I mean, or it just sounds very Trumpy to me. These were called Copperhead in the Northern press, basically because they're considered like, you know, venomous snakes that would strike at you from behind. Although some of them accepted the label and associated it with liberty in some weird way. So Copperheads were Northern pro-Southerners. And yeah, so I was trying to look up who they were. And there are several things you need to say about them. The most obvious one is when you talk about restrictions on civil liberties, well, there was a very, very powerful Copperhead, Vallandigham, who was allowed to keep preaching his anti-union talk for a very long time, and then finally punished only by being exiled to Canada. And the idea that you could have gotten away with doing anything like that, preaching pro-union stuff in any part of the Confederacy, is just absurd. You would have been killed.
Or fled for your life.
Yeah, yeah. So there was this faction. And you also, when you're reading memoirs from Union soldiers in the Civil War, they're shocked that the people up north who say bad things about the administration. I mean, they're a little simplistic in their own politics, maybe, but they say, don't you know that the Southern papers copy these things and put them in there and try to keep the war going? So there were these people, and a lot of them seem to have owned newspapers for some reason. The only info I could find on who they were is that they were white poor. They were Southern families who had recently moved north, or they were involved in some sort of job that meant they lost profit when the cotton trade was interrupted by the war.
Yeah, you, the more powerful among them, which had basically been parts of the Northern Democrats, tended to have, you know, this overlap of intense racism with economic interests. You know, Baltimore, some parts of New York, other places where their local base was some of the populations mentioned before. And they also were making a ton of money off the cotton trade. And when the war interrupted all that, that, you know, synced their ideology and their money, as these things do, synced up pretty neatly. Yeah. And it's interesting, one reason, and there were a few exceptions, though it's interesting that, you know, the lost cause was sunken so far. I've even heard some, you know, left-wingers who should know better say, you know, Lincoln's very lenient given the circumstances, you know, crushing of kind of insurgencies in Baltimore and riots and things like that, were, you know, kind of this temporary suspension of habeas corpus, so that were this weird beyond the pale action. Whereas, you know, no, they were generally pretty lenient, especially compared to the Confederacy. It helped that a lot that the North had a lot more of an efficient political system than the Union in general did. Like, they could just go arrest these guys, and in many cases, they didn't have the followings of the organization to, you know, have their own militias in the degree that, like, you had to go take a bunch of troops out and shoot them, other than, like, some states like Missouri that were, or Kentucky that were in contest. And it helped a lot of the Copperheads were idiots, frankly. Right. You know, like they were, and Lincoln, who doesn't get enough credit, partly because of the whole, you know, mythos that sprung up around him for being an incredibly brutal and canny politician, kept realizing to lay these idiots out to keep, you know, organizing these half-assed, easily provable plots against the Union, did way more damage to their cause than, you know, sending you know, a Union scout regiment to go, you know, put two in their head. It was better to leave them alive and incompetent. Than to, you know, kill them and make a martyr.
Right. Yeah, yeah. He shows incredible discipline and patience through the war. I mean, you can read accounts by very brilliant people like Adam Garowski, this leftist Polish emigre who is writing all through 1861 as he works as a translator for the federal government. Oh, these idiots, McClellan and these idiots, go down there and crush them. And, he might have been right about McClellan, but I don't think he quite understands the population that Lincoln had to handle. I mean, Americans were a little crazy, especially about race. And anything that turned this too quickly or too obviously in what could be called an abolition war would have provoked something that might have gotten well out of hand unless Lincoln made it seem that it was something imposed on him, something he had to do.
And then, speaking of people who were for or against the war, there are the robber barons. And there's this amazing anecdote from this book called Robber Barons that was published, I don't know, about 100 years ago, great book, talking about one of the sons of the Mellon family, you know, the big bankers and Gulf Oil and all of that. But this is when they're first getting very wealthy in the Civil War. And one of the sons of the Mellon dynasty made the stupid mistake when he was away in Wisconsin of enlisting for service and getting whipped up in patriotic fervor. And so here's what the father wrote, the sort of the head of the family. He said, "I had hoped my boy was going to make a smart, intelligent businessman and was not such a goose as to be seduced from duty by the declamations of buxcomb speeches. It is only the greenhorns who enlist. You can learn nothing in the army. Here there is no credit attached to going. All now stay if they can and go if they must. Those who are able to pay for substitutes do so, and no discredit attaches. In time, you will come to understand and believe that a man may be a patriot without risking his own life or sacrificing his health. There are plenty of other lives less valuable or others ready to serve for the love of serving."
Wow, and when you think of the stats, those would be the people who didn't die. The son who was a goose might have died, but the sons who weren't geese, they would have survived. And it's kind of easy to see how quickly the Republicans went bad after the war.
Yeah. Well, and this ties in earlier with an aspect that, every political party is a coalition, and some of those coalitions are pretty dang unwieldy. And certainly the early Republican Party was, in a lot of ways. It took someone like Lincoln to keep it together, and a fair amount of other pretty capable leaders, too. But it had this weird alliance at the beginning with what was, I think there's a pretty good argument for one of the most successful early left-wing movements in the U.S., as far as, we went from an 1830s abolitionist just getting the crap beaten out of him in northern states to being a serious contender in the space of 30 years. And for politics, that's pretty dang quick. But they also have these weird alliances with all these regional interests and a lot of different, basically industrial capitalists. And that especially lengthened over the war as, with the southern elite going one way. You had a lot of the Northern elite just, by dint of needing connections and power going the other way. And that's a faction that weirdly stuck around. And ironically, because they were also the people behind utterly betraying the Unionists and African-Americans and anyone who, didn't want the South to go back into what was a hell for most of them. They were the ones responsible for pulling out troops, for not doing federal reactions, things like the Wilmington coup. And now, you cycle on just over 100 years later, and it's finally gotten out of their control. They've been in the Republican Party the entire time. They were happy to, give a leeway to segregationists in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and they were happy to straight make alliances with them from, the Southern Strategy period on. And now finally, this kind of bargain has completely run its course, and it's funny to see the whinging from, like you mentioned, from some of these, kind of free trade or business conservatives about how did it all go wrong? It must be those silly plebs. It could have been anything we did. The elites don't have enough control anymore.
Which we traditionally end this show with, and on that happy note, after describing some hideous atrocity, but actually that is a relatively happy note. So for once, we've kept you more than 2 hours, David, and it's been fantastic.
Yes.
So maybe we should say, and on that happy note, we'll end the interview. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks, David.
Thank you all. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so that was our interview with David Forbes, journalist and former colleague of ours at NSFW Corp. And you can read his stuff at the Asheville Blade and be a patron subscriber. We're both subscribers. I'm definitely a subscriber.
Yep.
And also you can read his book, The Old Iron Dream. So that was a really interesting view of, I mean, it's something you never hear about the Civil War, about the pro-Union breakaway parts in parts of the South and how the South wasn't a uniform place.
What a brutal war it was. And you'll notice we kept coming back to Syria when we talked about the brutality of the U.S. Civil War as an irregular war, which it was in places at times, depending on where you were. You know, everybody thinks about Gettysburg and noble charges, and nobody really wants to think about shooting somebody from behind a tree, which was a very big part of the war. These engendered all kinds of very extreme violence that you get in irregular war. Like one of the most famous scenes in the Syrian Revolution was when the Sunni militias were officially the good guy, but then one of them got filmed cutting out the lung of a Syrian Arab army casualty and eating it. Well, you know, in one of these officers' memoirs I've read recently, a West Virginia Unionist who's been shot for his politics by his neighbors is found with his chest carved open with a big hunting knife and his heart thrown away into the woods. I mean, there was a lot of Syrian-type war. So it's just as well that we keep up with what's going on in Syria, because this is how most human wars are fought. And the biggest news from Syria this week, which I'll just talk about briefly, is the fall of Manbij, which is a really strategic town in northwest Syria. It's on the road from the small part of the Turkish border that's still controlled by Islamic State and the IS capital in Syria, Raqqa. And Manbij just got taken, completely encircled by the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, which is basically the YPG, the Kurdish militia, and some Arab allies. The SDF has been doing a lot better than I thought it would, because there's a lot of hatred between Kurds and Arabs in Syria, and I didn't think that this alliance would last, but it has lasted. And the result of this is that Turkey, our ally at the moment, for now, is very, very angry. Instead of being pleased that Manbij was taken away from Islamic State, the Turkish government is now saying, yes, but there are Kurds in Manbij. Manbij is not a Kurdish town. We can't have any Kurds staying there. And the implication is you, the U.S., promised us that the Kurds would leave as soon as they took the town. So we'll use them as our shock troops, but then they have to get away. So the U.S. will probably try to schmooze the Kurdish militias into getting out of town and letting ethnically Arab militias replace them, which might work. The YPG is showing a lot of political sophistication and patience so far, and that's what they'll have to do here. The other remarkable thing about the fall of Manbij is that an Islamic State contingent of several hundred, which was trying to escape using local civilians as a human shield, made a deal with American infantry, special forces, and drones, basically, to say, we'll put our weapons down and leave the civilians if you'll let us get to the Turkish border without blowing us up. That is not how they used to behave. They used to go out shooting and blowing up the suicide vests and killing every civilian they could. There have been a lot of stories about Islamic State morale weakening, and I discount those stories as a rule. But that was a surprising thing. That first that they lost the city, and second that they effectively surrendered after losing it, rather than fighting to the last man. That's not a good sign for a militia like that.
No, and now were surrounding Mosul. And
yeah.
I mean, they're basically down to Mosul and Raqqa. Yeah. I mean, they have other areas, of course, but those are the last two main areas in both countries.
Yeah, a lot of territory, but the total population is 6 million. A lot of that is empty desert. So the total population they control is only 6 million now. And what will happen is they'll go back to what scares people in the West a lot more, which is, you know, Paris, Brussels, that kind of stuff. They're not going to go away, and they'll always be a real faction in Iraq, but they might well lose their Syrian franchise. Have to go back to the core franchise in central Iraq. The other interesting news from Syria this week, and this fits very nicely with things that you and I have talked about, especially what you've been saying about Russian strategy, which you know far better than I do. The Russian Air Force has now staged air attacks using Tu-22s and Su-34s from Iranian air bases. Now, that wasn't something you usually saw the Soviets do. That was a classic U.S. Cold War move, where you co-opt your allies, you bring them in, you base your planes there, you get them involved, and pretty soon it's their war as much as your war. Their officer class is, you know, having a few drinks, well, maybe not drinks in this case, but after each mission. And just the general strategy of co-opting your allies and co-opting as many allies as possible is, to me at least, it has the feel of what the U.S. Army would call lessons learned. You know, somebody in the Kremlin does a lessons learned thing. What lessons did we learn from 1990? And they're very painful ones. And one of them is the Americans stuck with their friends, no matter how corrupt, no matter how messed up. The Americans wormed their way into their friends' military establishments as much as possible, involved those establishments, and it seems like they're adopting a lot of those Cold War strategies that worked well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree, and it seems to me also that they're also sending signals, for lack of a better word, that it's a kind of a harsh reminder that that the Russians and the Iranians. I mean, we have a very simplistic view of things. Iran must be a terrorist state and sponsors terrorism. Why would Iran, you know, it breaks brains a little bit here. Why would Iran be involved in attacking Islamic State, ISIS, which the world now all believes is the worst terrorist group in the world? I mean, it doesn't fit into the simple narratives. How can we get angry over that? Are we supposed to get angry that Iran lets Russia bomb ISIS? I mean, I think there's got to be a propaganda purpose to this as well.
You're right. Actually, I hadn't even considered that. I was just thinking of it as a pretty impressive move. But when you get the word, the two nouns, Russia and Iran, in a headline in most of the Western press, it means two villains.
Yeah.
So now two villains collaborating more openly than they were before. But to me, the more interesting thing is, you know, that's, ooh, what a NATO thing to do. What a U.S. Cold War thing to do.
Yeah, no, it is. And it was the cause for this bizarre press conference. I wish I could find the note right now. Somebody had sent it to me, a clip of it. But there was a press conference with some Pentagon people who are running operations in that region, Iraq, Syria. And somebody asked them, you know, so do you support the fact that Russia bombed not just Islamic State, but also al-Nusra, whatever they're called now? And they tried to get the guy to give a firm, you know, yes or no. And he just, remember early on when Russia first started bombing, the kind of the gobbledygook that was coming out of some of the mouths? It was the same thing. Like, well,
I'm not sure it's the same clip, but I've seen one of those guys almost become hysterical, almost hysterical laughter, like, come on, guys.
Exactly.
I got a family to support. What do you want me to say?
This ain't fair. It's an ambush. It's a gotcha. It's a gotcha moment. Yeah. And it's just the levels of bizarreness there. I mean, like we talked about last week as well, you know, everybody seems to be pretty much admitting that that the Al-Qaeda group and maybe Jaish al-Sham, or what was the other one that was Saudi-backed in a big way?
Jaish al-Islam, the Islamic. Yeah. And the new name is Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, supporters of the conquest of Syria, I think.
Right, which they've not changed their ideology one iota. They've just made a strategic decision to sort of formally break with Al-Qaeda. But everyone admits they're the ones that are fighting. They're the ones that won this thing, that won the Aleppo battles.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
And we don't need to be afraid of them. For some reason, we need to be afraid of Hezbollah, even though Hezbollah, you know, doesn't kill people for believing in the wrong version of God. Hezbollah is... They're not Boy Scouts, but they're not Islamic State either. But it's, as far as the people running the press are concerned, the real horror is the Hezbollah, Alawite, Russian, Iranian axis. And nothing that Jaish al whatever does is ever comparable to that risk.
Yeah. So I think on that note, we've had a good long show again, and so let's just wrap it up with that. I'm sure there'll be more interesting stuff in the next week as well. So
okay.
All right. Talk to you, John.
Okay. Bye-bye.